Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast and your Week in IndyCar listener Q&A show. A great weekend ahead of us here, the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. Cannot wait to get there. IMSA and the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, 27 cars, GTP and GTD, IndyCar with 27 entries, the Historic Motorsports Association Vintage Series, Robbie Gordon Super Stadium Trucks, SRO GT of some sorts, Formula Drift, and I might be forgetting another series, but it's going to be a blast as always. Driving down Wednesday morning and then driving back Sunday night, about 6 hours each way. So, woohoo! Coffee and fueling up as best I can both ways. Want to start off the show here, and then we're going to swiftly move into your questions. But I want to start off the show saying a massive thanks to all of y'all. Got an email from our podcast host this morning, Podbean, saying congratulations on 10 million downloads. So thanks, y'all. It's a crazy, crazy number. Started this thing, I think, May 8th of 2016. First couple years had very limited traction, just new podcast. Never had any kind of big network partner or otherwise. Just been effectively a one-person show, at least from the putting it together and producing it and whatnot side. Have some great co-hosts and partners over the years. This Week in IndyCar show started off with my late friend and colleague, Robin Miller. I have our dear friend, Graham Goodwin, been my co-host for many years with the Week in Sports Cars. And Stephen Kilby helps out there sometimes when I can't do the show. I can't even count how many guests over the years, many of them super return friends. So nonetheless, to all of y'all who've helped get the show to 10 million downloads for this little thing we do, all the show partners over the years, most have been the same. Cooper Tires was with us for 6 years, but moved on after they got out of open wheel racing. But nonetheless, let's say a big thanks to our show partners that are with us, make this possible. And then let's jump right into your questions. Get ready for Long Beach. Time to say a big thank you to our show partners on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, starting with FAF Technologies, build-to-print composites manufacturing company. They're specializing in medium to large-scale automotive, motorsports, and military applications. Visit FAFTechnologies.com. It's P-F-A-F-F, technologies.com, to learn more about their services and how they can benefit your business. Next, it's the Justice Brothers, makers of premium additives, lubricants, and cleaners, and servicing the automotive and motorsports industries for more than 85 years, with victories in all of the biggest North American motor races, including the Indianapolis 500, the 24 Hours of Daytona. The Justice Brothers products are truly race-proven. Learn about their vast history and range of offerings at justicebrothers.com. If you're fond of awesome motor racing collectibles, including FAF Motorsports McLaren gear and goodies, pay a visit to torontomotorsports.com. And finally, we have a new online merchandise home for the podcast, thepruittstore.com. All the show stickers, models, racing memorabilia I'm trying to sell and put towards our fund to buy a house is now live and rocking. thepruittstore.com. Ken Anderson, you open the show. This is MP, much love, brother. With Kyle Larson being successful in his testing at IMS, his recent string of poles and whatnot, ability to drive anything, have his chances of being a contender for the pole or top five in the race gotten any better for the Indy 500? I don't know if I ever expected anything less, Ken. So I'd say no. This is a guy who's a once-in-a-lifetime talent. To your point, can drive seemingly anything, but oval racing is his extreme specialty. So at least for the world of oval racing, there's no greater test than the Indy 500. And for one of the greatest I can think of that I've seen in terms of oval talent, this is right where he should be. Thing to look out for come race day, there's always some curveballs that a rookie arrives at and finds something they hadn't come across in all the practice running and whatnot and drafting. So that's just the part to be not concerned about, but just to keep your eye out for. It's not uncommon for the rookies to go left when they should go right, or make a wrong read on something and they don't end up getting the best result their first time out. Also got to hope that whether he wins the race or not, this wouldn't be Kyle's one and only. Andrew Miller, you say, who is most disappointed about the open test only lasting a half day last week? And who could have cared less? Guessing at least some folks weren't looking forward to 2 days of what most likely will be non-representative running, instead only worrying about what bad things might happen. You say a point to Joseph showing up in his road course car. Everybody wanted to get in at least a full day, Andrew. 2 days, if possible. Overstating the obvious here, but the margins of success continue to shrink and shrink and shrink. The separation between a Ganassi to a Carpenter to whomever, these things are tiny since the vast majority of them have not been on the big oval since last May. Everybody wanted to get in laps, even if the ambient conditions, the track conditions, would end up being totally different when we get to May and the real running starts. Every team had a big, long list of things to try, prove or disprove as to whether they worked or it was a good performance avenue to go down in the weeks leading into the start of official practice, and very few got more than partway through those lists. So short answer is everybody wanted to run 2 days. It certainly would have helped them prepare for the things that are going to happen when the real running begins. But what does this mean as a knock-on effect? Oh, I think we're going to see some really busy running when we get to that Tuesday right after the Indy GP, knowing that there's so much left undone. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see teams sitting or just opting to wait to specific times to run like we would in years past where they got in a proper full-length open test. Jaime Macias, you ask a question here that our friend Jeremiah Morrill and others have as well. Got a number of Prema-related items. Get through as many as we can. Jaime says, what do you think will be the main difference between Prema coming to IndyCar in comparison to the Carlin project? Been writing about this for about a week, and I hope to get this done soon, but money is one, and would say the caliber of driving talent should be the other. Know that Carlin was backed by Tom Chilton and Max Chilton's father, that being Chili, Graham Chili Chilton, super zillionaire. All was fantastic and greatly appreciated for what he helped the Carlin family to do to set up base here in the U.S. in Indy Lights and then move into IndyCar. There came a point, though, not too far into the IndyCar project, Jaime, where Senior Mr. Chilton said, okay, you guys need to start funding this through other avenues, and I'll put in some, or I could do some, but you're going to need to find drivers who pay for this or sponsors of your own. And that's where things started to trip up a bit. So, and no discredit at all to the Chilton family, just as Max pulled back on ovals and things went from him being full-time kind of team leaderish role to not as fully invested. We then saw the family say, okay, this is no longer kind of our project and program. And that's where we saw them start to stumble. I do not believe, from everything I know about Prema, they are going to have an issue with funding. I am aware of a couple of drivers who are said to be high on their list of interest for hiring, that being Alexander Rossi, Callum Ilott being another, not saying they're the only, just saying those are the two highest profile veterans of IndyCar that I know are routinely said to be on their shopping list as their lead driver. If they're able to develop some young talent behind one of those two, or maybe another veteran in that second car, then that'd be a great thing too. But what Carlin did not have to start was a true IndyCar veteran, hardcore race winning or similar front running style to lead them, bring a lot of experience, tell them how to structure the team. They lacked that. and the funding was the other part that became shaky. Sounds like Prema's approach should sidestep both. Riley Stricker, if Prema's allowed to buy a charter, when it inevitably gets rolled out by IndyCar, would that only go to the existing teams? Yes, is the answer. The current plan, the existing plan, again, all these things could change depending on what they decide to do when they finalize it, but the plan that's been expressed to me by the person who wrote the charter and by others involved with it is 25 cars based on the final results of the 2023 Entrance Championship. Meaning, if you weren't there, you weren't running in 2023, not getting a charter. Also say, so how would Prema achieve getting one if they weren't? Well, again, that's a sticky part here. The only way for Prema to get a charter, one of those 25 that would be made available, is to buy one from one of the 10 existing teams. I am unaware of any of those teams who would receive them looking to get out of the series or downsize and sell. So the short-term answer, at least, until the time comes, however many years down the road, where one of the existing 10 decides to sell one charter or sell all, is Prema and any other new teams who weren't competing in 2023 and within the entrance list and the filter that they've applied there that makes folks eligible, it's again the 10 full-time teams, they'd have to run as non-charter teams. Your final question here is, if the priority is growth, eliminating entrance after qualifying seems counterproductive. Says this sport isn't big enough to send entrance home. Totally agree. Was just speaking with a dear friend, team owner, involved in IndyCar about an hour ago, and they expressed the same exact thing. Can't afford to be sending folks home. But with this cap that they're talking about of 27 entries per race at every race, no more than 27 to take the green flag, other than the Indy 500, where they do 33. With that cap, that would indeed, with Prema being the 28th and 29th entry next year, put those two cars and the two from Chip Ganassi Racing that don't qualify or won't qualify for a charter, that would leave those four cars and any others that show up outside of the non-charter entries to vie for two spots on the grid at everywhere we go other than Indy. And that doesn't seem to me to speak to safeguarding the future, does it? It's great that we have the 10, now soon to be 11 full-timers. But again, if you're trying to inspire folks to come and take part, as I've written, and as I'll share again here, I am certainly concerned about a message of buy cars, get an engine lease, set up shop, spend a ton of money, and potentially go home a lot during your rookie season. I wonder how that might ward folks off from wanting to become new entrants in IndyCar. John Bailey says, with Prema getting two Chevrolet engine leases, does that tank the chance of Pratt & Miller getting a Chevy lease as well? Kind words about my wife and cats as well, and thank you, John. It certainly limits things. So just a quick little accounting here. 27 full-time cars this year. Honda powers 15, Chevrolet powers 12. It's what made the news of Prema getting two Chevy leases. It's news, don't get me wrong. Great news. Not exactly a huge revelation, simply because Honda's been at maximum capacity, so no matter who it was, we kind of knew Chevy was going to be the one, since they're three fewer than Honda right now in how many full-time leases they provide. In speaking with some other potential entrants, been told that Chevy's good at 14 for next year. Could that change? Again, who knows? But I think whether it's a Pratt Miller or maybe even an Able Motorsports, feels like full season leases are already committed for next year, So I don't foresee how anybody else would be able to get on the grid unless it was a part-time deal with either manufacturer, provided either Chevy or Honda felt inclined to do a part-time lease. Kevin Frederico says, with car counts going up and pushing the limits on grid size of certain events, why not run pit stops like F1 with two cars sharing the same pit box? Maybe the proposed charter system will have to be written to two-car minimum or four-car max per team. What are your thoughts? Yeah, I'm good with not double stacking. I hear you, but how many cars do you need? That's the central theme being asked in my new ESPN column that hopefully I'll be finishing up here when I'm done with the podcast tonight. 27's an amazing number. F1 has 20. NASCAR has what, 20? No, I'm sorry, 30. Is it 34, 36 full-time? And I think more can try and qualify. I forget the exact number, but like, it's a big number, right? Now we're going to be 29. Do you radically alter the way you do things to continually welcome in more new cars? Or do you at some point go, I think we're good. We got a ton. Let's just hold on to what we have, but look for avenues to welcome in new entrants. I've said somewhat jokingly, but not really, on previous episodes, what about a Saturday race, right? We qualify on Saturdays almost everywhere we go. Let's welcome more entries, but those who don't make the main show, you get to race on Saturday. Maybe those are reserved for Peacock or whatever the broadcaster is of the future on streaming. Hey, I love the idea of having more folks. The thought of jacking around with pit boxes and double stacking and limiting how many entries a team can have. I just feel like we're getting a little too far into the weeds instead of looking at the bigger question here of, hey, do we want more cars than we already have because we can barely manage more than 27? The answer's clearly been yes. They're welcoming 29 in. But do we then, again, change seemingly everything else about how we go racing? Or just go, okay, well, let's do something special. Let's not modify pit boxes. Let's not modify paddock space. Let's not. Let's just hold a race for those who don't make the A main show on Sunday, and we'll put on the B main late Saturday. Jordan Darwin, MP. Since your article talking about how the salaries can be on captain's driver's crew, I've been wondering how in play you think Joseph Newgarden will be this silly season. Continued prayers for your wife, Cherbell's treatments and strength. Thank you, Jordan. Seriously, thank you, man. Been a lot of praying going on in this household lately, for my wife and for others. I've had a friend who's another IndyCar entrant let me know that, cancer has visited his wife's world. So yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. I think Joseph will absolutely be massively in play, but I think there's a time limit to consider. Based on what I've been told, feel like I might have written this somewhere. All blurs together at some point, but been told by more than one prospective buyer of his services that Penske's contracts, driver contracts, tend to run through April or May. I've heard that elsewhere. Can't tell you if it's 100% correct or not, but this coming from someone who would seemingly know because they would are seemingly in the business of possibly wanting to hire, that would mean that the Joseph-specific silly season might be one that should be resolved by the end of May, no later than the end of May. And again, if there's something different, then I don't know about it and apologize if that's wrong. But yes, the main buyer, I think, if we had to look at who has what available, would probably be Arrow McLaren. Was told when I asked on the Andretti Global side, they have no intention of expanding to four cars next year to accommodate anybody. since reaching out and asking and getting that answer, been told by someone else that they might actually be willing to do that. So I've gone from Andretti Global not being an option to honestly just being unsure. I don't think Ray Hall is a place that Joseph would look right now, just because this is a guy who is starving to win another championship. And I say starving in the best way. Like, the guy's changed seemingly everything about his life almost in order to simplify, purify, focus 1,000% on the driving side and the winning of races and a championship and another championship and hopefully another Indy 500. Guessing here, but if I'm trying to put myself in his mind, I'm thinking, okay, certainly want a pay increase, and whomever I drive for, I got to know that they're either capable of delivering a championship right away or within a year or so afterwards, but not a short to medium term project to get them to a hopeful place of being able to get me towards a championship. So look, if it becomes known that Alex Palou could be hired, no jokes, folks, no jokes, or Scott Dixon or Joseph Newgarden or Pato Ward or you name it, anyone you're like, that's a title contender, Colton Herta could be hired, you would expect all of the usual suspects to say, hey, hello, amazing driver, we want you, what will it cost? So Joseph, I mean, he's what, one of the two best, three best drivers in IndyCar, period? Yeah, I would expect him to be of high interest. Would also hope, just because it seems like this is a good thing, I hope that he can stay where he's at, get paid more, because he seems like someone who could, for however long he wanted to, lead that team year after year, make them a perennial championship contender, and in theory, retire however many years from now, like what, five-time, six-time champion, three, however many time Indy 500 winner. He's that good. And I'm telling you, nothing new. But yeah, fascinating stuff, Jordan. Lord Thyke says, MP, what are the differences in how drivers approach a street course versus a road course? Are there major differences on the engineering side? Why, yes, there are. Going to keep this one super short because it could go on for a really long time. Thinking about a road course, you are thinking about, by and large, medium to high speed corners. Street course tends to be low speed to medium speed corners at most. Rarely, if ever, do you get a truly fifth, sixth gear corner flat out at 150, 70, whatever miles an hour. You're talking about a street course that tends to be, like Long Beach, one with a slower average speed, and you get to most corners that are fairly sharp, right? Lots of 90-degree turns, some even tighter. So if we're looking at the difference between a road course and a street course setup, pretty basic approach here. A road course, higher speed, often longer turns, right? They just take longer to get through. Looking for a car that's more stiffly sprung, that is really rock solid in its handling. It's not moving around a bunch front to back, side to side. Street course, very different. Tend to make speed in areas where you can crash over curbing, right? And really abuse the car over a lot of the curbs to extract little bits of speed or the bumps. Street courses tend to be pretty beaten up because of what they do on a daily basis with all the vehicles driving over them. And so you'll go for a softer setup, car that rolls around a little more, is more compliant. That's a common term that you hear. But you take a car with a full and stiffer springs and stiffer anti-roll bars and try and use it as a street course setup, you're going to be flying over the curbs and crashing into the walls compared to riding over them in a more supple manner. So So two general ways to think about the two different types of tracks. Luke Entrop. Luke, not sure if I remember a question from you. So congratulations if this is your first time or if I'm just forgetting. Thanks for coming back. It says, Marshall, I noticed the press release about the Laguna Seca lawsuit being settled didn't include any details. That was the best, right? Hey, we're going to send out information, but intentionally leave out just about everything you'd want to know. It's not uncommon. Luke finishes by saying, any limitations to track days or event sizes? And what concessions did the track have to make in order to settle? For those who hadn't seen it, local residents sued the track for sound limit violations and general being a nuisance as far as they were concerned. What I was told by someone super in the know and involved on the settlement side was, person who sued got nothing. Not talking about dollars. They weren't looking for dollars. It was trying to clamp down the track on a variety of things. I'm told that none of those things were done. I think there are some minor concessions you might have read about in it, about sound studies and maybe some other things, but effectively, this went away. And the other part that I was told that was pretty important is, in whatever agreement, the person who sued cannot sue again. So as it was expressed to me, this was as close to a total and complete victory by the track, county and otherwise. And the person who told me, someone who would absolutely know, because they would. Getting down to the last of the questions here in a shorter format, we might get into a couple afterwards, but we're going to get into the last few here to start, at least with our pal Steve Bonick. Says, MP, I hope you and the family are doing well and continued positive thoughts for Chabrel's recovery. Thank you, my brother Steve, and please give your family our love. Hope to see you at the track soon. So, Dale Coyne Racing, how unusual is it with the way they're rolling out their lineup for the season? Ever seen anything like this? Oh, boy. So, I happened to be on the phone interviewing Mitch Davis, team manager at Dale Coyne Racing this morning. Totally different topic. Said, hey, by the way, and I am admitting my idiocy here, which, again, kind of known and understood, but have you guys announced who's driving the 51 car Long Beach? For some reason, it just occurred to me you haven't. To which he said, no, but we're going to shortly. And told me who it was. It was in confidence, not a problem. Saw the post, which was a video saying happy birthday to Jack Harvey, and it was 9 seconds long, and it was them peeling the front part of the sticker off so you could see Jack's name being placed on the chassis. And that's awesome. So just in terms of me trying to get things figured out, earlier this year, the team announced that Jack would be doing 14 events in the number 18 Dale Coyne Racing Honda, and young Nolan Siegel would be doing the other four. Thermal, Long Beach, Indy 500, Toronto. Nolan, 4, Jack, 14. We had our pal Colin Brown in the number 51 at St. Pete and Thermal. We've had Catherine Legg confirmed for the 51 at the Indy 500, and she just did the Indy Open test. Confirmed Jack would be competing. Great. By video on social media, not a press release. That really stood out as strange. Knowing the aforementioned press release, Steve said, okay, just going on what they've told us about who's in what and where. So if they've nominated Jack and they've already told us Nolan will be in the 18 car at Long Beach, Jack must be in the 51. Wrote that. And then got a text, I don't know, an hour later saying what felt like a, hey, idiot, got the numbers wrong and who's in what car. And so I went back, looked at the video, and I'm like, did I miss something? No? Okay. Well, anyway, so I'm not sure what's going on. Their head of communications is amazing, as experienced as you get. would say they're trying some new things, maybe. I don't know. It's a weird situation they're in this year. I've gone into it before on the show. Happy to do it again in a future episode if someone wants to know more about it. But I feel for them. I hate the fact that it feels like almost a race-by-race thing of who's going to be in the 51. But yeah, I wouldn't argue if they wanted to do just the more traditional, here is something written that clearly confirms who's in what and when. And if that did go out, maybe it fell off my email server. Hey, Corey Johnson says, can we get a status update on the Abel ride for the Indy 500? Is RC Enerson in or Jacob Abel? I don't know. Need to call and ask tomorrow, most likely. Just ran out of time today. I know there was a big milestone they're hoping to get through last weekend on the build of the new car. Jacob's an interesting question. It's the only one I can offer a little bit of insight on. There was a belief that he would not be eligible as a driver since he has done zero IndyCar Oval testing, rookie, anything with the series, and so on. So although he did test an IndyCar and did one day, I think again with Coin, at Sebring 5, 4, 6 months ago, however long ago, to my knowledge, Jacob has never done an IndyCar Oval test. Again, could be wrong, but was told that's the same concern on the team side. IndyCar would not be open to receiving an entry with his name on it because of the total lack of IndyCar Oval experience. Chris Hoffman, MP, any upcoming books about IndyCar racing or people involved in the sport I should be on the lookout for? Seem to remember I heard there was going to be a book about Dan Gurney. Updates on if that was true. So you wanted me to provide an update on whether something is true or not, or do you just want an update as to whether the book is happening? I will see the Gurney family here on Wednesday afternoon. I will do my annual check-in on the book. I sure hope it's getting close to completion. I'm failing you a bit here, Chris. I am aware that Gordon Kirby, prolific author of IndyCar-related books for the past many years now. I forget which one or ones, but I'm told that he has more in the pipeline. I believe John Oriovitz, last time I spoke with him, or maybe the time before that, he told me he has a book, another book in the works. He penned the widely applauded and not super nice job done with the Indy Split book. I feel like I heard about someone else, a book about someone else, IndyCar related, and I'm forgetting. It's just a part where I just make a general apology and say, as crazily paced as my life has become, boy, the retention factor, my old noggin, it is suffering. So apologies, I don't have a lot of specifics that I can recall here, but the answer is yes. Save your money. Please buy books about motor racing and IndyCar and all that, because we need to give those publishing houses a reason to stay in the fight for sure. And as I remember more, hear more, I will make a note this weekend to ask folks. I really will. Hey, what books are happening? I'll see Oreo for sure. I'll ask him, and then hopefully I will type notes into my phone, and then I will try and remember to provide that next week. All right, we are ready to go. I, though, am going to take just a couple more here and say a big thank you again to our pal Jerry Siddeth, who puts together our questions for us every week and tries to do so in an amusing way. Jonas Magnuson got a question about Kenny Brack. I am clueless about it, so I'm going to ask our man Bob Rahal about this here. Brad, you're asking, coming out of the open test, Graham Rahal stated in his post-test presser that their issue last year was due to non-optimized parts. He would not elaborate further or say which parts he was talking about. Any ideas? Without him giving us a clue, it's hard to say, Brad, but if we're talking about optimized versus non-optimized, tends to be things that have had time and money spent on to reduce mechanical friction, rolling resistance, right? Whether it is gearbox, the gearbox itself, a lot of time, a lot of money is spent on gearbox dynos, right? To measure the resistance and look for ways to reduce that through the bearings. Also the uprights, right? The four outrigger pieces of the suspension that hold the brakes, hold the wheel, connect the wheel and that entire assembly to the suspension A-arms. Well, in those uprights, you have big old wheel bearings that allow those four Firestones to spin at a high rate of speed. And yes, indeed, there is some really good work that should go on to massively reduce the rolling resistance of the wheels and tire assembly. I think I mentioned before, this was years ago, maybe 2015 or so. It's with a driver in their Indy 500 garage gasoline alley. End of the day, long day. Crew had just left. I popped by there to see them for whatever it was, to ask a question, maybe do a super quick interview, and just stopped before we could do that. Said, hey, you want to see how much time they put in on my car on reducing the rolling resistance? And his car was up in the air. One of his teammates was up in the air. It was a full-time driver. This was an Indy-only driver. They were paying for the ride, too. And their teammates spun, I think it was the left front wheel, and it just went bzzz, super, super free and just spinning and spinning and super easy. Then did the same exact to one of his wheels and tires on his car, and it did about 25% of the revolutions. And you could just see, like, oh, there is some stickiness here that you really don't want. And that is something the engine has to fight through to push that car through the air. And that robs power, robs performance. And that's a reason why one car will be a little bit slower than the others. So I would guess this is where he's talking, but there are other areas, aerodynamic optimization as well, body fits and such, but hard to say exactly, but those are the prime areas to think of. And when things, as I mentioned at the start of the show here, Brad, are as close as they are in IndyCar, qualifying being razor thin at the Indy 500, these are the little differences that can have you bumped or not bumped. So yeah, taking what he said that you said, and I recall reading a little bit of that, sounds like RLL has made sure that any of their cars that head to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway are indeed properly dialed in on the optimization side. Dave Heisen, you say, is my favorite little Dave driver. Does he have one foot out the door at Arrow McLaren and the other foot on, say, a banana peel? I sure hope not. I hope Davey is not in jeopardy of losing anything. Haven't been told this by anybody, just stating what I believe is going to happen based on things that I know. I will be very surprised if little Dave is confirmed for Long Beach. Hope that he is. If he isn't, you can absolutely look for Teo Pourchaire to be in the car. Where else do we go here real quickly? JJ Gertler asking if Brian Highspeed Herta will be taking part, or his son Colton be showing up at any vintage historic IndyCar racing appearances like this weekend at Long Beach. The answer is no, according to Brian, who told me his plan for that car was one and done. Wanted to do it once and then park it and just soak it in, getting to share the car with his son, and that be the finale. Travis Watry, MP, am I losing my mind, or did you have some methanol-fueled 2.65-liter turbo V8s as a sound bed two or three episodes ago? I did. I don't want to do it every time, but yeah, I'll just throw that in every now and then just to spice things up. Hey, it might get us to 10 million and one downloads if I'm not careful. Funny, just the way things normally work. I had about 50% of the people say, oh, that was really cool. If you were to stop that after this one time, and then I seemingly had about the other 50% say, that's awesome. Keep it going. I love it. So, yeah. Same thing with, oh my God, please shorten your show. Oh my God, why is the show short? I need it long. Like, I suck, apparently. There's a happy middle ground somewhere here. Apparently, I never find it because I'm always told that I need to do the opposite thing that is conflicting. But yeah, did try that. Not going to do it all the time. But yeah, do it maybe a little more often going forward. Also, he said, if you did, say Jimmy Blind, Joe Tonto are confirmed for Prema in 2025. Thoughts and prayers for you and Mrs. Pruitt and Rocky and Rosie. Well, thank you. All right, I'm going to tell you, they are confirmed in Prema. Brian Cohn, it's been a little while since I read a question of yours. Where else do we go here? Derek Bartichek asking if I'm going to be in Toronto. Maybe. Haven't been there for a while, but I hope so. Patrick Gaffney asking if there'll be a change to the Indy 500 compound. I need to ask Firestone this weekend if that's at all possible. I doubt it, but I'll have to see. Other than that, Randy Maynard asking if Prem will be the ones to get IndyCar, Ferrari to IndyCar. It'd be amazing knowing that they're the Ferrari F2 development type team, but yeah, that'd be a weird pipeline, but I mean, we'd love to see it, wouldn't we? Jamie Rowe, MP, with Prema coming in, with what looks like strong funding and a pipeline of solid drivers, just possibly some contraction with other teams, would that allow Prema to buy one or more charters? I don't foresee that contraction happening. If it does, it will happen, I guess, but Juncos is not looking to go down to one car, to my knowledge. Meyer-Shank is not looking to go to one. Foyt's not looking to go to one. Carpenter's not looking to go to one. Coyne's not looking to go to one. Could those things change? Maybe. RLL going from 3 to 2, run again. I'm not aware of any team currently planning on downsizing. So that's where at the moment, I can't see that happening. So we'll close here with Brian Cohn. Marshall says, I'm confused by the talk about limits on charters. Says, well, at the same time, there's growth on the team side. Says, how does a new team acquire a charter? Well, again, if you weren't running full-time in 2023, you're not getting one unless a team wants to sell you one. Mentions as well that limits on car count seem very counter to growth potential. One of IndyCar's strengths is that it's not a closed-door society, and it sure seems like the charter process will eventually close the door. Yeah, I keep looking for ways where that won't happen. And there's a bit of protectionism here. Not as bad as we've seen in F1, but there is a bit of a closing of the ranks. We're the ones who are here currently. We're the ones who've made IndyCar what it is. We put on the show. Take care of us. I get it. It's totally natural. The same time, fortunes rise and fortunes fall. Duh. But, right, IndyCar is currently going through a boom cycle with its entries. What happens if that starts to trend in the opposite direction? Have you run off those who were interested or who did try and come in but failed to qualify and got tired of it? It's that part that I definitely am continuing to bear in mind about a potential flaw. Had another friend today, just to close here, mention on the topic. So let's say you're a non-charter team and you fail to qualify. So what do you do with those tires? Do you get a rebate from Firestone or IndyCar because a number of new sets and whatnot went unused on race day? Doubtful. Hey, let's say you fail to qualify for a number of events. You pay your $1.45 million for an annual engine lease. Let's say you only use 2 of the 4 because you failed to qualify for half of the races and only need 2. Do you get a rebate for $700,000? Doubtful. What do you do? Like, it's a lot to consider here, Brian. I don't know where we're going to end up, but I'm crossing fingers and a variety of other things, all hoping that the folks who are currently here feel well taken care of, while folks who, and we don't have this very often, express an interest to join IndyCar, aren't driven off from the concept. All right, y'all, thanks once again. 10 million downloads, thank you so much. And to our great partners at FAF Technologies, TorontoMotorsports.com, and the Justice Brothers, a Marshall Pruitt will speak to you very soon.